Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest is Tim Hill. He is the co-founder of Social Status. Social Status is an online platform for social media analytics so that you can get more data about how your posts on social media like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram are doing against your competitors. He started his venture out of Australia and attracted users from all over the world. Today, he's going to share tips on how to get traffic to a new product and how being in an incubator can help your company grow and how to improve your chances of getting into an incubator. Tim, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thanks, Rohit. Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So, Tim, before you ever started Social Status, right? Before you ever started your first entrepreneurial venture, what was your life like?
Very boring. I was, you know, I started off wanting to actually make films. I studied film and TV at university, so I wanted to be like Jerry Bruckheimer. Really, that was what I wanted to do. I got into TV, and then that led me into the advertising agency world. So I spent about 7 years in advertising agencies, working in strategy, so social media strategy, digital strategy, and I guess that was really where the genesis of Social Status. That was where I originally had the thought to, you know, there's got to be a better way to quantify social media performance.
I see. Where in the globe are you right now?
I am in Sydney, in Australia, right now. But yeah, I've kind of been doing a little bit of traveling between Mountain View and Sydney.
I see. So you have been building most of your company in the last few years from Australia, Sydney.
That's right.
I see. Yeah. So when you were doing your full-time job, what happened that gave you the idea for Social Status?
I think what happened was Social Status was formed to, you know how they say, you know, scratch your own itch. Like, there was a problem that I had with my clients when I was in agencies, which is that, say, for example, you know, we had a client brief come through that said, the purpose of this campaign is to increase engagement on social media by 20%. And I remember just thinking at the time, like, where is this number coming from? Like, is this, they've just plucked a number out of thin air, you know, there's, what has actually informed this? And what I really needed, it was a very personal need, what I needed to understand was, from all of the activity that the client was doing on social media, from the what the competitors were doing, how can we set better data-led targets, KPIs, and how can we actually measure effectively so it's not based on intuition or guesswork, but it's actually based on data-led insight.
I see. So what was your role in your full-time job that you're dealing with the analytics portion of it?
I was a digital strategist. So it was really my responsibility to turn all of that data and all of that activity on digital and, well, specifically social media, into insight for my clients.
I see. So, and then you would work with your clients and you were not able to promise what engagement they would get for your clients. Is that
true? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's why, you know, social media, I think, has sometimes been a little bit of a laughing stock in the boardroom, because it's always been such fluffy metrics, you know, and it's been so hard to set data-led goals or data-led KPIs. It's just been just very tricky to actually quantify it and actually quantify full funnel. So not just how many people we're reaching, but how many people are engaging, how many clicking through, how many actually converting. And if the business sells online, how much revenue is being derived from social? That's an easy thing to say, but it's actually really quite hard to do. And so that's one of the specific problems that Social Status is trying to address.
I see. So you were doing your full-time job and you had this thought. What did you do with it? You didn't quit your job, did you, at that time?
No. So I started talking to a very good friend of mine who became my co-founder. And he's the CTO and really the brains behind the organization. But we started working together on this product, really. But it was a very personal need. So as I was saying, it was really for me to help me do my my job better. But the idea was, you know, could we commercialize this, and could we actually turn this into a product that thousands or millions of marketers could use around the world? But it started off with just one user, which was me, and how could I use it and do my job better from it?
I see. So I meet a lot of full-time employees who have problems in their daily job, right?
Yeah.
And I don't see them go in the evening and try to build a company to solve it. So I'm really curious to know, what was it that motivated you to take this outside your company?
Oh, stupidity. I think most. I think yeah, you know, because it is quite an adventure. But I think, look, I think it was the opportunity, really. It was the fact that you could see that this was a real burning problem in the marketing and advertising industry. And this wasn't just felt in the agencies in Sydney. This is a global problem. Every business, brand, agency that uses social media, you know, literally around the world, we have signups now from all over the world. And I love to see that this problem, it literally exists everywhere, is how do you save time and report more effectively? How do you measure social media effectively? How do you make better decisions from the data? And I think just seeing the opportunity in market and seeing the growth in the social analytics sector was really enough to get us excited about
actually. So you saw that the... Sorry, go ahead.
Well, yeah, it actually made us got to the point where it was enough for both of us to actually take the step and quit our jobs.
Yeah. So at that time, when you thought of this idea, you saw that, okay, if I have the problem, and you read the market and you saw that many others have the problem, which is what motivated you to come outside the company and start building it. Yeah. So from the time you had this idea, I believe it was in late 2013, right?
Yes.
At the time that you're still working.
Yeah.
To the time that you quit, how long was it?
Nearly a year. Actually, you know, when you, I think from memory, the anecdote is that it was like 9 months. It was like the gestation period of a human, you know, like this was the baby, you know. I think it was around 9 months that where we actually, that was the point at which we thought, yeah, that we, you know, it's social status is born and it's time to kind of, you know, go 100% all in.
What did you do in those 9 months?
We worked hard on getting, as much as we could, the product to a point where it felt real and usable. You know, and it's actually a challenge that we still balance today with our feature set and functionality and knowing where we're trying to go. So getting it to a point where a user who doesn't know us or doesn't know the product could log in, do some stuff and actually get some value out of it in that one session, that was where we were wanting to get.
So you were solely focused on building a great product in those 9 months.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, trying to find others with the same problem that, you know, I guess as well, trying to understand how easy was it for us to find others that with that problem, and would they ultimately sign up, and would they pay money for it?
I see. How would you do that? How would you find out whether others have the problem?
It was really about using our own networks. So the good thing about being in advertising for 7 years was that, you know, I had a reasonable LinkedIn network. I knew quite a few people in the Sydney marketing advertising industry. So connecting with others was reasonably straightforward because of that tenure in advertising. You know, doing tests as well with some paid spend, but really it came down to just leveraging our own networks and going to events, marketing events in Sydney and meeting other marketers.
So you talked about paid testing, right? Can you tell me more about that? Well, how did you do it?
Yeah, so I think we stumbled at the start with paid. I mean, you know, one of our ideas was, let's launch the product as a free product and get as many people kind of using it, and then we can figure out the pricing later on. But when we first went out with our paid plans, a lot of advice was to go in high and, you know, try to prove value, perceived value in a high price point, never discount and all that kind of stuff. And I think that ultimately, you know, that wasn't the right decision for us at the time, and we've over time found that you know, actually doing the opposite, going in low and discounting heavily and doing things like that, it was actually a lot more effective. But I think it also goes to show that like what works in one industry is not going to work in another. And I think doing that testing yourself and finding that out yourself is really the only way to do that.
I see. And you actually in late 2014, you said you quit your job, right? So what happened that you got the confidence to take this plunge and do it full time?
Yeah, I think at that point, you know, there were a few stars aligning. The main one from a social status perspective was, you know, I think at that point we'd already got up to a few hundred users, so it felt like a real thing. We weren't just, it wasn't just, you know, 5 or 10 users here and there. There was like a few, and I think the other thing that we noticed was that there was a core set that used it a lot. And so if we could understand more about the attributes and behaviors of those core set, then how do we encourage that in the other users and how do we kind of find more like them? But I think it was really the point where it started becoming real. Like growth was increasing, not like huge, like up like that, but growth was increasing and it was enough to suggest this is a thing. There's a market here and there's a need for it and people are willing to use it.
What was your revenue at the time you quit?
Well, it wasn't a lot. You know, we had a small handful, under 5 paying customers. So it was literally, you know, $1,000 a month, if that. It was very low. And, you know, I think the good thing was is that my co-founder and I, we both have very supportive partners that are willing to support this, you know, a crazy entrepreneurial adventure. And so, you know, that was how we were able to bootstrap this on such a low revenue base. So that was good. And you know, I think that's for a lot of entrepreneurs, that's always the thing is like, how do you bootstrap the business? How do you kind of stay alive? Because, you know, there's this thing that you always hear is like the startup doesn't die because no one wants it. It's because the founders give up. And so it's like, you know, if you just persevere and hang in there and kind of keep iterating and getting it right, then that ultimately leads to success. But it's hard. Like it was really hard going from having a full-time job and knowing, you know, the certainty of a paycheck to having nothing. Mm-hmm. And we bootstrapped for quite a while. You know, it's only last month that we closed our first angel round. So now suddenly, you know, we have some resource to grow, but it's really tough.
Yeah.
Really
so your good. Confidence was if I could make $1,000 a month from 5 customers, if I scale it 10 times, I can make $10,000 with 50 customers and so on.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So you know, trying to do the pattern matching, you know, like there's potential there. Let's try to, you know, keep growing that and actually, you know, try to accelerate that. I mean, and that's a lot harder to actually do than say, but that was the thought. Exactly.
I see. Do you remember the day that you quit?
Yeah, I do actually. And I will always cherish the present that my co-workers got for me, which was, it was a big jar and it was just full of money. It was like all coins and you know, $5 bills and stuff. And it was something like, you know, startup survival fund. It was like break this jar and like get all the money if you when you run out of it. I loved it. It was such a great present from them. I had to break the jar very quickly actually.
Yeah, it reminds me of the in terms of a joke which was running around in 2000s. In case of Y2K problem, break this jar, and inside that there'll be a pencil and a pen. Yeah. Y2K problem is the one where they coded all the computers with
exactly, yeah.
with only 2 digits. So when we went from 99 to 2000, there was an issue.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. Let's go back to using pen and paper.
And you can open the jar and go back to using the dollars.
Yeah.
So you quit your full-time job and started doing social status full-time. And at that time, you said you already had your customers, right? So what was your focus after quitting when you started doing full-time in social status? What was your next step?
You know, I actually think part of our problem perhaps was that there wasn't a clearly defined next step. I mean, we wanted to grow, but then how do you define grow? Ultimately, we wanted to get we wanted to prove traction. I mean, that was the point at which we were starting to look around, like, how do we raise money? How do we kind of, you know, start to accelerate this? And know that if we want to raise money at this point in the future, we actually have to start that process now, start developing those relationships, because that takes so long. So we wanted to try to get to traction, but I think in our minds we didn't quite know what that meant. But what ended up happening was just onboarding users, because we're a freemium product. You know, the barrier to entry is very low, so you can onboard for free, start using it for free. But ultimately, you know, we also needed to get to sustainability, so we needed to convert into paying users. Those really were the two things. I mean, obviously, the other aspect of that is improving the product and making sure that we can actually convert with the product we have. But I think we were focused on, and not having a laser focus on this, because I don't think we kind of knew, but I think growing the user base and converting freeze to paid were the two.
And the trouble that you were mentioning earlier was that because of the lack of focus, that you got detracted from one or the other, which made you spread thin. And do you want to talk more about that?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, even back then and still to this day, I definitely feel like, you know, there's so many things in front of me. I'm just speaking personally for me, so many things in front of me, and trying to understand which ones are going to provide the most value to the business right now. That for some things is really hard to determine. So you try to do a little bit of everything, and I think, sure, that's problematic, because then you can't go deep and really kind of. So, you know, if we're talking to a partner and we want to partner on a report, and it ends up being that, you know, we can't deliver as much data as we can, or you know we're partnering on an event, but we can't make all the things work because, you know, we just didn't have enough time to organize it. So things like that, like you're constantly having to. I'm constantly having to switch from this to that to this to that and multitask to the nth degree, which everything you read about, you know, optimization and the whole Tim Ferriss thing is like not to be so scatter brain, but it's kind of a reality. And I think as well, I've almost kind of embraced it and accept that's it. It's just, what are the things that I can do to improve how I make that decision making? But I think at the start, yeah, I mean, it was all over the place, and I'm sure we were spending a lot of time on things that perhaps turned out to be of little value, but we'd never know that.
Yeah. So what is one thing that you spent a lot of time on, which you ended up scrapping or not using much? What is one feature?
You know, from a feature perspective, I think from a feature perspective, things like, say, you know, we've got a lot in the product where the user has to determine, after looking at an insight, like looking at a chart, what it means. So we'll create all these charts and graphs of all of these different metrics and all these different, you know, the best times, the best days, the best media types, the best themes, the best frequencies. So we're loading up the product to show all of this stuff. But actually, what the user wants is they want the insight, and that showing them all the data means that they have to do a lot of interpretation. And some users want to do interpretation, but a lot don't. A lot would like to have the ability to do that. But what's the kind of capstone of that is, like, can you just tell me what I should be doing next? What is my next best post? What are the things that have been working in the past? And so kind of automating the analysis and interpretation into like a bullet point list of, here are the things you should be doing, is ultimately what we need to do.
I see. As you were explaining the features, It struck me suddenly that we never talked about the product as it stands right now. Do you want to, since we talked about it just before hitting the record button, it sounded familiar to me, but do you want to just take a minute to explain exactly what socialstatus.io looks like and what it is on the inside?
Exactly. Yeah, sure. It's a social media analytics platform. We say Google Analytics for social media. So when a user uses social status, they add all of their social profiles as well as their competitors. So when you add your competitors, then you can benchmark your performance against your competitors and against your industry. Because, you know, a lot of the problems is that as a marketer, you look at your, say, Facebook insights, and that might say, you know, you've got an engagement rate of 1.35%. But is that good or bad? Like, you know, what does that actually mean? So then if you know, well, actually you're the top engaged brand versus all of your competitors, or you're the lowest, or you're mid, so that competitor benchmarking allows you to understand that. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the kind of features and functionality that help you.
I see. So let's say I'm SanDisk, which is the company where I work at. We sell memory cards.
Yeah.
And I can go to social status and add my company's social profile like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and also my competitors like Kingston and other memory card suppliers. And then you would look at the actual posts, how many likes I get,
correct,
how many comments I get, how many views I get, and then tell me whether my posts are doing well compared to my competitors or not.
That's it. I mean, at the moment, our product works on Facebook. We've just added Instagram, and we're about to implement Twitter integration. So yeah, we're slowly adding channels. YouTube, Pinterest, Tumblr are all coming this year. But that's first and foremost why users sign up, is to do that competitive benchmarking. But then the reporting side of things, because, you know, a lot of marketers need to create weekly or monthly reports to their CMO or their CEO or whatever. And generating those reports is really painstaking and time-consuming for marketers. So then, you know, another part of social status is actually that reporting and report automation side, which, you know, involves a little manual work at the moment for us on the back end, but we're working towards 100% automating those reports.
I see. So you get all the detailed reports on how much engagement and so on. But I guess I wanted to ask you, what platform did you start with and how did you pick what platform to start with?
Yeah, we picked Facebook. The reason is that, you know, it was one of the most robust in terms of, you know, how marketers can use it, and how we as a third party analytics platform can use Facebook's API to deliver insights to our users. So that's the great thing about Facebook is that, you know, there's a lot that it provides to through the API, and I think that was a considerable reason. The other is that there's you know 300 million pages and small businesses and brands using it. It's like so many marketers use Facebook too, and it's certainly, you know, now in this country anyway, in Australia, there's 14 million active monthly users. That's over half our population. So, you know, really it was the channel to pick. But I think what we found out very early on was that marketers don't just use Facebook, they use Instagram and YouTube and everything else. So trying to get across multi-channel is almost like the thing at the top of our list.
Yeah. So when you said 10 million and that's half of Australia's population, you're laughing at it, but there used to be a joke in India when I was growing up. I'm from India, and the joke runs like, there is an Australian who comes to town and he goes to a movie theater and he thinks that the whole city is in the theater because there are so many people, right? And the city must be free.
We are a tiny country. I mean, and I think, you know, we're 23 million people is the total population. And I think, you know, that also highlights to us that this is not our market. You know, the US, Europe, Asia are our markets. Yeah. We just happen to be an Australian company.
Did you code it all yourself, or your co-founder, his name is Robert, right? I was just looking up on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Did he code it all himself, the Facebook, the first version?
He did. That's all his work. So, yeah, he built that all from scratch. And, you know, over time, we now have another engineer on the team. But over time, you know, we've used some freelance resource and some part-time resource. But definitely the first product, and for a long time, it was just him.
I see. How did you grow your customer base in the beginning?
Yeah. We used a few methods. I think really leaning on our networks, you know, and having 7 years experience in advertising, you kind of build up a network of people. So, you know, LinkedIn was great for that, and reaching out to people that I knew, other marketers. We did a lot of events as well. So we partnered with others. We were present at industry events, which were just, you know, that marketers would go to. We went to tech events. We went to kind of industry events. Like, there were a lot of things that we went to and had a presence at. And that got us in front of people. So really, it was a combination of the two of those things. And then as time went on, there were other moments that, that led to, you know.
So, yeah, exactly. I want to get to that moment. What happened at the Big Pitch competition?
Yeah, so the Big Pitch last year, and it was held in Melbourne, and it's actually, you know, one of Australia's biggest pitching comps. It's held at a venue called Federation Square, and it's going to seat 300 people, and so it was actually a really big event, and we were really lucky to have been shortlisted as a finalist. We pitched on the night, and it was live streamed, and the people watching from all around the world, and we were really lucky to win, and it was a fantastic night, and I think that that led to ultimately, you know, a few other things that happened. We got into an accelerator, Hackers and Founders in Mountain View, and that led to a listing on Product Hunt, which was huge for us in terms of traffic, and then.
So how did that happen? Did Product Hunt reach out to you asking if to feature?
Wow. So I remember this quite well. I was in Mountain View at the time, and it was something like nearly midnight, and something started happening. So we've got our site connected through on Slack to a channel there specifically about kind of monitoring what's going on the site, and there were a few signups that. All within the space of a few minutes of each other. And generally, if that happens, then a company has signed up and they've invited their coworkers. And so when I saw that behavior, I was like, oh, I wonder which agency or what company this is that signed up. And they weren't connected. They were all individuals, non-connected. And I thought, there's something weird here. So I was trying to track down the trace. I had no idea that we were listed on Product Hunt. And I figured it out after going into Google Analytics and seeing the referrer in going into real time, and because it was literally happening as at that point in time, and the referrer was Product Hunt, and I go on the producthunt.com, and we are on the front page of producthunt.com. And you know, we'd always planned to do this like months and months in the future when the product's got a few more features in it. So I at that point was trying to figure out, how did we get on here? Who's listed us? I didn't even know who the person was that listed us. And you know, at that point, I contact my co-founder who was back here in Australia, and we're just sitting back watching all of these signups. You know, in this short space of time, we had over 300 signups. We had thousands of hits to the site in just, a short space of time. But we were totally unprepared for that. But we ran with it because it was fantastic. You know, it led to then helping us close our angel round.
Yeah. So when you say you were unprepared, what do you mean by that? In terms of features, or in what terms?
Yeah. In terms of how we optimally wanted the product to be, and at that point in time when we were listed, because you know onboarding could have been a better process. You know the. Our channels, you know, we were only on Facebook. You know, we wanted to get a few more channels integrated, but you know, these things don't happen how you plan, and I've very much come to accept that. So, you know, I'm fine with that, and I think I definitely see it as a positive. Although, you know, when you look at our listing, certainly there were people that were in the comments, you know, saying, oh, like the onboarding was a bit clunky, but like, you know, I get it. Like, but you know, I apart from that, I just think it was a fantastic thing that happened for us.
Yeah, when I look at the traffic on your website, it went from 10,000 views per month in September to around 30,000 in October. And I believe that was from the Product Hunt post.
Absolutely.
How did the user base grow in that time period?
Over 300 users signed up. I think it was something like 340, 350. And yeah, you know, that's huge. That was huge for us. And you know, I'm like, the thing is that these are still small numbers, but we haven't done any considerable marketing, any PR activity. You know, it's still been very, very much flying under the radar. So that was a big thing.
Yeah. When did you drop your prices?
Previous to that, we dropped them actually when we launched the product at CeBIT here in Sydney last year. So
before the pitch?
Before the pitch. Yep. Okay. Yep. And you know, it was definitely something that we tested over time, but as we kept dropping the price point, we made the barrier to entry lower. And I think
so what did you start with? What was the price when you first started?
We were going out to market really high. We were going out at like, you know, 800 a month, depending on who we were talking to, because there's a little bit kind of POA on the price. But if this was a big brand, we were going 1500 a month. You know, it was definitely in that more enterprise realm where it's a human selling to human. You know, you're not going to onboard and do all kind of sign up for SaaS at that kind of price point. And I think that immediately puts, you know, we wanted to build a scalable global SaaS business. And I think going out at that point, the theory was, you know, if we can convert a few, then we've got, you know, good amounts of revenue coming in to build the SaaS part. But I think that it was a bit of a distraction. I think if we'd kind of gone in, you know, all perfect to say in hindsight, but if we'd gone in at lower and kind of converted at a higher rate on a lower price point, we would have gone for volume at an earlier period.
So was your goal initially to go only after enterprise customers and then later you change it to consumers?
We were kind of doing both, and I think that was another problem as well, was not picking. And I'm still not 100% sure whether that's you actually need to. In other words, you know, I'm at this point in time we're certainly SaaS pricing. You can use social status for like $49 a month, but I think definitely that it's a viable model to have that enterprise aspect of the business there, so that we can sell into the thousands per month, but only when the business can support it and when that functionality is actually available. Mm-hmm. So I think it's all about timing, actually. And I think it was just a wrong time for us to be trying this kind of dual approach.
So when you dropped your price from enterprise prices of hundreds of dollars to what a small business could afford, how did it show up in your revenue numbers? Was it good? Was it how did that react?
Yeah, it was good. But what we were finding was that although that entry price point is 49, you know, our average price per user was more like between 300 and 400. And I think that's that kind of point of, sure, the entry is low, but then that user wants these other features too, and wants to add more data and wants to add more time, so like time visibility in social status. And so that actually then moves them up the pricing tier. And I think that seemed to be a much better approach, was to take that Hootsuite model of getting the user in for Hootsuite's like $19 a month. So it's very cheap to sign up. And then you can kind of keep ratcheting up and adding features and functionality, and then before long, perhaps, you know, you're paying a few hundred, and you know you're experiencing that value progressively, rather than trying to get them over the line with a high price point and all this value that's intangible.
I see. And what are your revenues right now like?
Yeah, I mean, still low. You know, we're coming up to a kind of, depending on the month, kind of $4,000 a month. So you know, it's we're not you know, printing money by any means, but I think we're certainly at that point where we can see that if we do these particular things, that increases, you know, the conversion, and it increases the average revenue per user. So yeah, it's been this slow growth. I think now with the seed round that we did, now we can actually start to scale and increase that rapidly.
Yeah, can you tell me more about the seed round? What did you guys do there, and how much money did you raise? And what are you planning to do next?
Well, actually, it was an angel round. We raised 300,000 Australian, which is kind of 225 US. And I think the whole purpose of that raise, that angel raise, was really to get us to profitability, scale the business in a way that we can then prove a lot more value to our users. We can also do paid acquisition and kind of put more efforts into marketing and paid activities and get to break even. Our goal certainly is to grow a viable, strong business in social media analytics. We want to be the default solution, because there actually isn't one. I think that's what's really interesting, is that if you're using lots of different social channels, there isn't a default application for measuring effectiveness. There is, for publishing. Hootsuite is the default. They have 10 million users. If you want to publish on social media, use Hootsuite. But there isn't a default solution for analytics, and I think there's such a big opportunity for us to be that. So that's really our goal. That's where we're heading.
I see. Now, how many users do you have right now?
We've just crossed over 1,000 users. I think we're coming up to 1,100 users.
Most of them are enterprise or individuals? How is the customer base like?
It's really diverse. Some might say that that's a problem, but I actually don't see that as a problem, because what I look at is actually their challenges. So we have small business users, single person businesses, all the way up to large, and in some cases global corporations and agencies. And I think that's a testament to the fact that no matter who that person is in the organization, their pain point is very similar, in that they want to understand social performance and they want to optimize and they want to report on it. It's a very simple and kind of straightforward need that a wedding photographer has, who uses Facebook for his business, up to the largest gym chain in the world. So I think that really says something about the pain points.
So in terms of scaling and growing your company, right? You are talking about how you want to segment between Australia and the US. Now you are in switching between the two places, right? So what is your plan with how you want to structure your company going forward?
Our intention really is to keep the engineering team in Australia for a number of reasons. I think trying to compete in over there, like in Mountain View, is tough. It's very hard to find people, and you're competing with every other tech company, which is really, really tough. There's certainly less competition in Australia, but it's still a tough market. There's really a supply issue. There just doesn't seem to be enough developers going around. But I think it's a little easier here, and that there's great talent coming out of the universities in Australia and around the world. That's true in many places. So the intention is to keep the development team here, and the kind of marketing and biz dev and partnership team in the US.
So you are in the US, between back and forth between US and Australia now, right? I'm curious to know, do you see any cultural differences in the between US market and Australian market? Not just in the user perspective, but also from as an entrepreneur, as a founder.
Right? Yeah.
How do you see the ecosystem here versus there?
Oh, there's so many differences. The burgers are so much better in the US than Australia.
What's your favorite one?
I had this one, Johnny Rockets, is it?
Johnny Rockets? Yeah.
Johnny Rockets?
Yes.
It was the most greasiest kind of, like, it looked like disgusting, but it was so, so delicious.
Yeah, it is very tasty. Try In-N-Out in your next
Visit. In-N-Out as well. Yeah, that's a love. I probably overindulged a little bit with In-N-Out too. But I think from the ecosystem standpoint, what the US clearly has is that history. They've got so many success stories. There's such a great tenure of tech, and that's what we don't have here. So that's why there's less investors. There's less people willing to take a punt. I think there's kind of less. There's a smaller ecosystem here. That's slowly changing, and it's changing all over the world, really. But that's such a huge difference, because when we think of Australian success stories in tech, we can probably count them on our fingers, whereas you'd need many fingers to count in the US, and I think we just don't have that here.
It's more mature. But you, as an Australian, do you find any challenges here in the US culturally as well?
Culturally, I haven't really experienced that. I mean, I think really, speaking to users and understanding problems, the thing that has really got me is that, not just in the US, but speaking to a user the other day in Norway, spoke to a user in Cairo, I spoke to someone in Jamaica not so long ago. I'm really enjoying speaking to these users around the world. And what I love is that the conversation I have with them is actually quite similar. And they tell me similar things about pain points and solutions and what they need, and that's really like heartwarming, for an entrepreneur that's trying to fix this this issue in our industry, is that actually no matter who you talk to, the pain points are the same. I think from the startup, though, going back to the startup ecosystem, generally I find, speaking to other entrepreneurs in the States, they're a lot more willing to help, willing to share. There's that very much more that pay it forward kind of mentality over there, which is really great. We don't have that same mentality in Australia. It's a lot more protective, and it is like just, and that comes with, as you said, that maturity. But that's really very noticeable over there. Everyone's so happy to help and connect you. And there's pockets of that here in Australia, certainly with some people, but less so.
I see. And what is the one resource that helped you in your entrepreneurial journey that you would like to share?
There's been many, actually. But if you try to boil it down to one,
You can give me.
Can I give you a few?
More?
Okay. Look, I think the accelerators have been great. So we've been part of two, and that's iAccelerate here in Australia, which is just an hour out of Sydney, and Hackers and Founders in Mountain View.
So do you have an entry? I'm thinking about the listener who may not be a part of the accelerator, right? So something valuable for him.
Yes. So in the case of Hackers and Founders, we met the Hackers and Founders representative in Australia completely out of the blue. So we met them at CeBIT, that event where we launched our product. Mm-hmm. They just came up to our stand because we had a little booth, and we started talking. That was literally how we met them. So it was completely out of the blue. And started talking, and he was like, I'm involved in this accelerator. This might be good for you guys. Have a look. And we found out a bit more about it, started talking, and that was it. So it really did come down to that relationship, I think.
For anyone who is on their entrepreneurial journey, you would definitely recommend trying to get into an accelerator to help things.
I think that's really a good way to go, because a lot of entrepreneurs come with the kind of industry experience. So I came with the marketing and advertising background. And so they've got this kind of certain domain knowledge, but they may not have that kind of tech or kind of growth, business, dev kind of knowledge. And I think that's what an accelerator can bring, and that's what's helped us so much is being able to lean on their network, lean on their connections, get their advice, connect to their mentors, connect to others the other startup founders. That's also extremely valuable, is actually that shared experience of it's not just you going through this, but a cohort of other startups that are experiencing the same challenges, and you're kind of working together. I think the beauty as well with hackers and founders, which is a little bit different to a lot of the others, is that you give up 5% of your equity to the accelerator, but it's actually a co-op. So you gain back 1% of the pool of everyone else. So you're actually invested in all the other of your cohort, which puts a very interesting lens on things, because you're incentivized to help your cohort. Ah. And I think even without that it would certainly happen. But the fact that there's also almost like a financial incentive to help everyone, it changes things, I think.
What is one thing that someone can do to improve their chances of getting into an accelerator?
I think it's really actually about the people and passion, because everyone knows that at that point that you're not going to have that huge, you know, traction. I mean, maybe it's different with YC and 500, but you don't have that huge success already, and if you did, then you don't need an accelerator. So what they're looking for really is individuals that are so incredibly passionate about the problem, and can also prove that passion through they've spent their professional life working in it. They know the problem back to front, or you know they can at least communicate that they know that problem back to front, and that they're also, I think the other thing that also got me is that this ability to be mentored. So you know they're looking for people who can actually take advice and criticisms and all that kind of stuff. I think a lot of the challenge is just getting is people. It's a people thing, and a lot of that decision, is actually made off the people, and then the idea and the market and blah 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 all those other.
So have a passion, know your market really well in and out, that the selectors will see that passion, and have the mindset of growth, or being able to take criticism and being able to be mentored.
Being able to be mentored, exactly. Okay. Yep.
Great. So if someone who is listening wants to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do so?
Well, being a social media analytics platform, you can contact me on all the social channels. Yeah. Twitter is good. So I'm Tim at TimHill22 on Twitter. I'm TimHill22 on LinkedIn as well. So linkedin.com/in/TimHill22. That's probably the best way to contact me. Yeah.
Sure. So I will leave all the links in the show notes as well, so that if someone is driving, you don't have to crash into the next car.
Yes. Unless you're in a driverless car, then you take as many notes as you want. Thank you, Rohit. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I've really enjoyed it. Yeah, thank you.
Tim Hill, the founder of Social Status. I found that the way that he transitioned from being a full-time employee to an entrepreneur very interesting. He started very gradually building the product on the side while he was still working, until it was promising enough for him to quit. It may also seem that he got lucky with his product being featured on Product Hunt, but luck only favors the brave. He did put himself out there by going to pitching contests, talking to people, and networking in general, which indirectly helped him to feature on Product Hunt. All the show notes from this episode can be found at breakingtheborders.com/Tim, and make sure you subscribe while you are on the page to get latest updates. Until next week, stay ambitious.